It's the Diseducation edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, hitting the kids crazy, why hate standardized testing, and the diseducation of children, the perils of Christian homeschooling. Let's begin episode 173.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan.
Yes.
You didn't do that right. You didn't do it right again.
So what's your...
How many times am I going to have to smack you around before you learn your lesson?
How long are we going to go with this?
I don't know.
Okay. So, as what Dawn is alluding to there, our first segment here on the show is a bit of a follow-up to a couple segments, a couple shows ago. We talked about corporal punishment. And recently, a study has come to light that shines a bit more science on the whole issue of corporal punishment. Now, we discussed before that, what is corporal punishment? How is it different from child abuse? And does punishment of this nature actually work? And during that discussion, we sort of found out that it can be effective, but only for a very temporary, short-term basis. And then the long-term effect is that it's, well, not very effective at all. Well, this new study has come to light that has shown that, in fact, the long-term consequences of corporal punishment can be very, very harmful. In fact, leading to various forms of mental illnesses like depression and social anxiety disorders, such as things like that. And this new study has been published in the journal Pediatrics by Tracy Affini, who is in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the University of Manitoba. The study looks at diseases like depression, anxiety, alcohol and drug abuse, as well as personality disorders. And they may be attributed to physical punishment. So this was defined as like pushing, grabbing, shoving, slapping, hitting, going up to that point, but not further than, you know, severe maltreatment or what we consider child abuse, sexual abuse, that sort of thing. And what they did is they looked at the National Epidemiological Survey on Alcohol and Related Conditions, the NESARC, complicated acronym, which is a representation, a sample of civilian non-institutionalized adults in the United States. They also controlled for socioeconomic status and whether people came from a broken home. And then they correlated with the people who, you know, had these mental illnesses with were they punished physically as children. And they actually found out that there was quite a good correlation. People who were physically punished had a statistically more likely chance developing these long-term mental illnesses. The sample size was about 34,000 people, so it was a pretty good base to make such a conclusion. But they weren't able to prove a causal link, so at the very least, we can say there's a fairly high probability that corporal punishment can lead to these mental illnesses. So, I mean, a good follow-up to our previous discussion, where we were kind of on the page that corporal punishment didn't seem to work that well. Or if it did work, it was because, you know, if you slap a kid in the face, they're probably going to stop what they're doing and, you know, be like, why did you just do that?
Right.
But it's not going to have a long-term effect.
Well, I think what you're getting at is the idea is that, you know, people can become habituated to any situation. So you sit there and you smack them and, okay, they stop. Then they do it again, and you smack them, and then they eventually stop, and then you smack them, and they go, yeah, I know, that's the price I'm paying for doing what I'm doing. I've learned that. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, you exactly. Know?
And it loses its effectiveness over time.
And then there's the sort of unpleasant aftertaste of, you know, are you teaching your child to solve problems with violence? What effect is this going to have on them as they grow up and how they interact with people? And based on this new study here, that they may develop some pretty serious consequences of, you know, growing up with that kind of physical punishment.
Well, you know, and it's funny too, and this might relate into our later topic, because I was just listening to a show called Best Left, and they had one of the segments on there were talking about a minister who was saying, you know, if you think that your child might be gay, right, what do you do? And he says, well, you know, if you see that limped wrist, you crack it. You know, if you think they're being too effeminate, you punch them, right? And I think that's what we're sort of, you know, the second part of this is going, is that not only are you not solving your problem in the end because people become habituated, but if you grow up sort of in a culture of violence, that becomes the norm. And then when you go out and you think any problem is best treated as with a hammer, you know, and literally, perhaps in this case, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the other problem, of course, is that you know, kids grow up; they've been physically punished, so they'll physically punish their kids, and it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, and it perpetuates, you know, the unfortunate mental illnesses that develop from long-term use. So someone becomes a bit high-strung. So they're more likely to abuse their kids in the future. And it's you know, this unfortunate cycle.
Well, you know, and I don't want to get all cultural or psychological evolutionary on us all here, right? But in one sense, this actually does kind of add some credence to the idea that humans by nature are not violent. That if we are violent, at least in a habitual state, that it actually has detrimental long-term effects on us. Because again, the results of this study wasn't so much to show that corporal punishment is ineffective. We've covered that before, as Ethan has mentioned. But that if you get that, that it will cause psychological effects that are actually in some ways not relative to what you're doing. Because again, if your father beat you, then you beat your child, you can kind of say, well, okay, A leads to B, but that seems somehow equally connected. But I mean, you know, agoraphobia, that sort of thing, you know, substance abuse, you know. And again, we're not talking about taking a cigarette butt to your child's arm. I mean, it's not, quote unquote, child abuse as you think of it in a more classic sense. This is just you spank your child, you know, grab them, say, oh, get away, don't do that, right? It is more light corporal punishment, if I can use that term. But that creates such a sort of unnatural, if I can use that word in quotes, environment that it causes the maldevelopment of one's social psyche, or at least that was one of the results of the study, or at least my interpretation of the study.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate interpretation. I mean, that's sort of what they're going at, and that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of pediatric organizations, both in Canada and the U.S., which are two of the, you know, few Western countries that still even allow spanking, are putting forward, you know, stronger recommendations to, you know, not physically punish your children. And, you know, certain jurisdictions within Canada and the U.S. are taking steps to ban that practice.
You know, and I think one of the takeaways that comes from this, I mean, from what I'm reading with some of the last comments of the researchers and that, is they're not saying that, you know, you can get rid of all sort of family violence in the sense of corporal punishment. If your child is about to put his hand on the stove, you're going to smack the hand. Okay, you know, it's not like, you know, you ever raising your hand to your child is always a bad thing. But the idea is to take the whole ethos, the whole idea of violence towards children and make it like, oh, that's wrong. There better have been a really good reason. Sort of like murder, right? I mean, society says murder is wrong always. Well, okay, if someone is about to kill you, we'll make an exception for that. So it becomes very unacceptable, improper. But still, under extreme circumstances, you could say, okay, yes. And that if we do that, if we make these gradual changes, we won't eliminate corporal punishment. There's always going to be A, bad parents, and B, as I say, these exceptional circumstances. But we will at least reduce the whole level in general and make a society a bit better place to live in.
Yes, we will have to educate society.
Ooh, education.
Yes, which is sort of the theme for today's show, is it not?
Yes, there is a bit of a thread that winds, threads wind, through all this. But you know, before we go on, Ethan.
Yes.
True or false, standardized testing is good.
Oh, that's a tough one. I'll have to go get some prep exam and then, like, practice for 5 hours. and then have a nervous breakdown. So standardized testing, as Don alluded to there, has come up in my sort of newsy feeds. I actually read about this on the Boing Boing.
That's a technical term?
Yes, it is. The Boing Boing website, I saw this story about standardized testing. And, you know, if you're one of those people that those words fill you with fear, then this story is going to give you some vindication. It's an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post by a high school teacher who, in addition to teaching, was also an administrator, a curriculum designer, and an author. And the author is writing about, well, basically how bad standardized testing is. And we've actually talked about this in the past, I believe, one of our earlier shows. So he lays out some arguments as to why teachers should oppose these tests. So just to go through some of them, one is because they focus so narrowly on reading and math that the young are learning to hate reading and math and school. Another reason, because they measure only, quote, low-level thinking processes. Also because they put the wrong people, test manufacturers, in charge of American education. Let's see, because they allow pass-fail rates to be manipulated by officials for political purposes. Also because test items simplify and trivialize learning. Let's see here. Because they provide minimal to no useful feedback, are key to a deeply flawed curriculum adopted in 1893, lead to neglect of physical conditioning, music, art, and other nonverbal ways of learning, unfairly advantage those who can't afford test prep, hide problems created by margin of error computations and scoring, penalize test takers who take non-standard, who think in non-standard ways, and he goes on. Now, these reasons are probably not all that new or revolutionary. They've been, you know, mentioned before, and for some reason, no one seems to listen. So I just thought I'd mention just a couple of the reasons why standardized testing sort of exists. And one of the main advantages is that it's a bulk of empirical knowledge that we can document. So we can say, look, we know that we have tons of different students across this country, but with standardized testing, we can get, you know, a fairly good idea of where they all are at in terms of understanding math, of understanding chemistry, of understanding English. So that's pretty useful for an educator, and it's pretty good when we're looking at education from a national lens, right? Now, we can contrast this with, you know, the grades on a school transcript, especially if we're talking about grades for elementary or even secondary students. Now, those are assigned by individual teachers, and, you know, we have to account for things like the teacher's biases, their education style, the culture of the school, the students. These are really difficult things to measure and to account for. So standardized testing gives us an alternative to that sort of sticky situation. Now, I mean, all of those complaints about standardized testing are perfectly valid. So the question is, how do we create a system that, well, allows us to get a good sort of national view of how we're doing at educating our young, but without all the bad things that go along with it?
Well, I think part of what's going into this is there are sort of cycles in educational theory. If you go back to like the 50s and that sort of era, it was like rote memory, right? You memorize things, you spit it out, right? And then as you had sort of the liberation of the 60s and the 70s, it was more like the facts are not so important as long as you know the process of thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's when you had sort of the first instance you had a disconnect where people knew the information but had no real idea of how to apply it. Conversely, by the end of the 70s, early 80s, people knew how to apply their information, but they didn't actually have any information to apply. So in a way, you kind of had two forms of dumbness.
Yeah.
Right? Now, of course, the pendulum has swung back to do that. But both of those systems, I think where the real fault lies, is in their dependence on a single form of system. So as Ethan has mentioned, standardized testing in and of itself is one good way to sort of keep an eye that everyone is sort of meeting certain minimum benchmarks. But what's occurred is that those are the only benchmarks are in there. One of the fights that a lot of teachers are having is that, you know, their performance is being strictly measured by these standardized tests, and they're not actually being measured by their performance in the classroom. And yeah, that's where this over-reliance has created this sort of the bad effects to amplify, because they're always going to be there in certain things. It's like, who publishes textbooks? Oh, we might talk about that later.
Yeah.
You know, someone's got to do it, right?
Well, yeah, the problem of teaching to the test, basically, you have these teachers who are put in a pressure cooker situation because their school will lose funding if their standardized test marks go down too low. So instead of, you know, teaching, for example, let's say English, teaching kids to appreciate Shakespeare and act out the plays and enjoy the material, they're like, okay, you know, we're going to go over this. I'm only going to tell you the main points. You're going to memorize the characters. Boom. Move on to the next thing. And, like, who's going to appreciate anything out of that situation, right? So there has to be a happy medium here, I would think, where we can get a national a measuring tape of where students are at when it comes to math or science or history, while at the same time find ways to creatively engage them. I don't think it's that hard to do, but it just seems like there's lots of roadblocks here. And textbooks are one of the big ones, unfortunately.
Well, and as you point out, that, you know, part of the issue that's expanded this is education is no longer about educating children. It's a political issue. And with these era of let's cut back and let's save money, let's cut back, you know, how much you give a school for funding, how can you figure out a way to cut back that or incentivize is... Incentivize is such a weird term in some ways, because you sit there and you say, listen, everyone's going to lose $100 a year, a month or what have you, and those who do good will get an extra $10, right? So, I mean, you've really reduced everyone's wage, and you pay a little bit more, but not that much. So you call it, I'm incentivizing teaching, but really it's just a good way to hide a cutback. So when politicians sit there and they say, well, we want something simple and easy to measure so that we can do our job, they want to rely on this. But part of my thinking is, and you get this a lot with healthcare as well, is politicians, that's not really their job. I mean, their job is to ensure that the legislation, you know, what is, what's what I'm looking for here? The laws are created in such a way to enable education, but the actual education of children, the measurement of children, should be done by these schools and the educational institutions in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. I think how you can have partly a happy medium here is you stick to sort of the standard test as a general guide, but the actual running of the school is left to the principal and the academic staff in the particular school, who will ensure that the education system is overall. Now, of course, you can't just leave them blankly. That's where the test acts as a counterbalance. But if everything is dependent upon the test, then children are not learning in education. They're learning how to do tests. In fact, there was this huge case, I believe, in New York with cheating, right, where the teachers in collusion with the principal, in collusion, oddly, with the students, were all cheating on the test to make sure that their test scores were sufficiently high. Because it's not only that the school's going to lose money, especially in the States, not so much here, but teachers will lose their jobs if their numbers do not make high enough things. And it also causes a disincentive for those teachers who have a gift and like working with troubled children, mm-hmm. is because lots of times those troubled children will never really do good on standardized tests because of either social or physical issues. But that doesn't mean they're hopeless. But teachers who sort of specialize in that will always have this handicap because they do. They have these children that are difficult to learn and will never perform or have the same increase in performance that you get with a regular class.
Well, that's part of the problem, is that one of the big criticisms of these tests are socially and culturally biased, so that unless you're a part of that culture, you're not going to do well in them. And then, of course, the other problem is, as you mentioned, students who just don't learn that way. And maybe they learn a different way. Maybe they'll grow up to be artists or something. But the point is, like, you need to have enough flexibility within the system that you can accommodate all these different styles and situations. So, we should figure out a way to solve this problem. They will listen to us.
Well, and so just to spread the crap around, you also mentioned in there briefly that it's big business.
Yeah.
Right? When you sort of take the education of the student away from the teacher, as in the people who make the test, the testing industry itself is a vastly growing business in North America. And they want more and more emphasis on testing, because the more emphasis on testing, not only do they get to supply the tests and the marketing material, et cetera, but all that prep stuff that you were mentioning beforehand, both in school and out of school, is big business for these folks. And I mean, there's an incentive for them to say, we really don't care about the child's education per se, we just want to provide a means of measuring this particular result.
Right. So then lots of problems to be solved, but nevertheless, we will solve them in the commercial break.
Yes.
So stay tuned, and we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So, as we said, the theme of today's show is education. Dom, what can you tell us more about education?
Okay, so I guess we're going to take sort of an extended look into homeschooling. In particular, ACE. No, not the flying kind or the one in your royal flush, but it's an acronym for Accelerated Christian Education. This has been a popular topic on the interweb because of new lax textbook requirements in places like Louisiana and Texas. However, ACE has a Canadian branch which has been providing homeschool Christian diseducational material for years now. Some of the books on their website for ACE Canada are George Washington, the Christian, A Case for Creation, Ordained of the Lord, and Shadow of the Almighty, which are sort of what you might expect from a Christian group.
Is that all one book?
No, those are several books.
Oh, okay. That would be a really strange book.
Yeah, actually. You know, any authors out there, you want to come up with a good fiction book, and
yeah,
who knows? You
George Washington, the Christian, A Case for Creation.
But, well, there was one there, though, that actually kind of caught my attention. None Dare Call It Conspiracy. This tasty bit combines the communists, environmentalists, transnational, the UN, and others to form your slightly off-standard conspiracy theory a la One World Government, New World Order, Illuminati. His style, a little less Christian but more libertarian, but still in that vein, is known as producerism, where the productive people of the world are being parasitized by everybody else. Now, this is acceptable to the ACE people because they share some common themes, like traditional value. There is the sort of Christian ethos in there. God rewards the righteous. And, you know, biblical end time scenario, the whole persecution sort of complex. The first chapter, though, I thought is very telling. It's entitled, Don't Confuse Me with the Facts. This, I think, very much is in line with ACE teaching philosophy. So we will not only talk about, you know, the bad science in these works, which has been talked to quite a bit on other shows, but also some of the bad social scientists and some of the more sinister implications of this style of teaching. First, some things children are being dislearned about science. The Loch Ness Monster disproves evolution. According to the Christian homeschool dislearning material, quote, are dinosaurs alive? Scientists are becoming more convinced of their existence. Have you heard of the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland, or Nessie? It has been recorded on sonar by a small submarine, described by eyewitness, and photographed by others. Nessie appears to be a plesiosaurus. Close quote. Close quote. Quote. Nessie appears to be a plesiosaurus. So dinosaurs are not millions of years, but they've existed with humans. Now, the fact that Nessie has long been shown to be a myth. I mean, even the cryptozoologists have pretty much given up on this one. Nessie, you know, was pretty much disproven when they had a complete sonar scan of the Loch in 1987. They did it again in 2003 for a show called Search for the Loch Ness Monster on the BBC, which again found nothing. The sonar blips, which were mentioned and is one of those things, was actually figured out to be an effect caused by high waves in the Loch. So now, the Loch Ness Monster, though, it's still trending in popular press. So it's an easy plot point. Everyone thinks they know. And I use the word plot point here because I think religion, like fiction, you have to remember your plot throughout the whole story. We remember the photo evidence, which, of course, was not actually photo evidence, a bunch of blurry photos.
Which were actually disproven.
Yes.
Years after the fact.
Exactly. And the dramatizations that you often see, the Loch Ness Monster or something like a Loch Ness Monster in popular movies. But we rarely remember the depression we feel when we see a real documentary show that proves that it was all just fiction and not true. Along the same theme, a Japanese whaling boat found a dinosaur like Nessie. Now, they have nice pictures about this, and this is supposed to be, again, evidence that proves that dinosaurs are still around. Of course, the evidence, as I mentioned, is a couple of photos of what was hauled up by a Japanese fishing trawler in the late 70s. If you look at it quickly, you might see something that might look like a long neck thingy. But the conditions of the carcass was extremely decayed. That is, there is no skin, little flesh, and looking at it, it's your standard sort of well-decayed thing, possibly a shark, or at least that's what they thought it was in 1977 when it was found. I mean, we've kind of talked about this on the show before with things like the chupacabra or various mythical animals wash up on beach. When you get a high state of decomposition, animals no longer look like they looked when they were nice, fresh, and alive.
Or if they're sick or something, or if their fur is falling out, they look really weird. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to look at something and go, oh, that's something else. I mean, you can do it with clouds, too.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things, too, because it's all in pareidolia. And, you know, if someone tells you, oh, you see that thing there? That looks like a neck with a head on it. And you go, oh, thanks. Now every time I'm looking at that, I'm going to see a neck with a head on it. Continuing on with their quote-unquote evidence, they also state that humans and dinosaurs coexisted because fossilized human footprints have been found alongside dinosaur tracks on the Biloxi River in Texas. Now, there are a number of photos of these on the internet. If you do a quick Google search, you'll see quite a bit.
Are they screen capped for the Flintstones?
No, not quite. although, now that you mention it, there was one video that had Wilma, but I don't know. However, there have been sort of two explanations for this apparent anomaly. First, they were faked. I didn't actually know about this one beforehand. The most convincing human footprints, complete with toes, are actually souvenir rocks. And if you see them on the internet, they're not actually on the riverbed. They're sort of separate. Not in situ would be sort of the term. Apparently, it was quite a booming business during the Depression to sell moonshine and fossils. When either ran low, they just went out to the shack in the back and made some more. So, of course, the other explanation for these, for the ones that are in situ, and that, again, if you look hard enough, you might see something, is that when the tracks were made, the soft mud falls into the track, giving a sort of distorted appearance. Coupled with the erosion from natural elements, you can transform a three-toed dino print into a human-shaped sort of heel print. These rarely, if ever, have anything that even remotely looks like a toe. And again, you know, if you look hard, you can say it might be a human, but then again, it's more likely to be just an eroded footprint from a theropod.
Right.
This was something that, again, people in the community will know, but was new to me. Solar fusion is a myth. Apparently, they believe that the sun is shrinking, and some of the people, the Banana Man, Kevin Holvin, right, is a big expounder that the sun is actually shrinking. And it's doing so because it's burning out its fuel. And I mean fuel in the sense that, like, you'd have in your barbecue, natural gas type thing, that when it burns, it disappears. Not the I'm rational and I believe in nuclear fusion, because Hiroshima proved to me it could be true. So the main tenet of this is that, you know, the Earth can't be billions of years old, because if it was, the sun would have been bigger than the orbit of the Earth in that way, right? So essentially they're saying, ha, the sun is made of real gas, and so therefore the Earth cannot be around that long, otherwise the sun would be bigger than that. Ha ha, take that, science. And I mean, again, if one of the questions, and I would hope maybe there's someone out there of a theological bent who may actually be going, oh, you guys are so wrong about this and you're so wrong about that. I could not find anywhere else to find out if they actually deny fusion in and of itself, or it's just solar fusion they're denying. Because, I mean, like I say, it would be kind of hard for them to deny, at least, if nothing else, at least, to go into a nuclear power plant which uses fission. But, I mean, it's a very similar sort of process and would sort of disprove, I think, their theory about what's going on. Or, again, you know, the hydrogen bomb. The hydrogen bomb was a fusion bomb. Another one of their bugaboos that they try and disinform students about is the second law of thermodynamics, which they say disproves evolution. The second law states that entropy of a closed system cannot, the entropy of a closed system decreases. That is, if it takes the meaning that as systems age, they go from an ordered state to a disordered state as time goes by. Therefore, the Earth was created in a perfect ordered state and is progressively becoming more decayed and disordered over time until, of course, according to creationists, the big G pulls the plug. Now, in a closed system, strictly speaking, this is true. The order does decrease over time. And that's what the law says.
It's however, the law.
Yes. However, life, Earth, and even the galaxy are actually not closed systems. Life on Earth gets increasing amounts of energy from the sun, just to name one thing. It inputs energy into the system, or in the, our context, order, into this evolutionary system, thus giving the appearance of violating the second law, but actually not really. So essentially, to recap that, perhaps in a bit more coherent way, the second law of thermodynamics says that in a system, we go from a state of order to disorder. Therefore, if evolution was true, we would have to sort of start out with a perfect human and evolve back into a less perfect, more disordered chimpanzee, as they would put it, because that's the way the second law works. What they're missing is the fact that it's a closed system. We get more energy in, which allows for us to have more complex life forms because of the sun and the rest of the universe.
Yeah, and aliens.
Exactly. They're real.
Yeah.
Got one in my head. Another one that they keep saying over and over again is that there are no transitional fossils, that they don't exist.
That's just wrong.
Yeah, I don't even want to go there. Just Google it and you will find a gazillion. And they always use that sort of, you know, well, you know, you found something but it's between a whale and a bear. I'm going to say bear. I don't think it's actually a bear. I think it's more of a pig. But whales evolved from land animal and this bear. Okay, well, we found one in the middle. Oh, yes, but you don't have one between that creature and the bear. Okay, well, we found that one. Well, you don't have one between that one and they just keep shifting the goalposts. And that's just not the way it works. Now, what they have said, of course, is that, you know, so you have all these missing links in there. So scientists believe in the hopeful monster theory.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The theory states that certain organisms experience, for some unexplained reason, a dramatic genetic disturbance that hurls them across these gaps left by missing links. They have actually kind of a cute cartoon that explains this, at least as they see it. It's sort of like the last hope for evolution. So in line one has a fish plus a fish equals a fish. The next one has a fish plus genetic disturbance, ooh, some spooky thing, equals a frog. Now, this is what I can only believe is willful misunderstanding of evolution. I don't want to restate what many may obviously believe, at least our listeners would believe, but there are like basically two major camps for evolutionary thinking, gradual evolution and punctuated evolution. The first holds, of course, that gradual change over hundreds, thousands, millions of years gradually selects adaptations best suited for the organism's environment, thus leading to speciation, as in new species develop. Your basic classic evolution you took in school. Punctuated evolution, which is still controversial, posits that in isolated groups, like those stranded on an island, I don't know, let's say the Galapagos Island, evolution can be accelerated and more dramatic, that you can create new species in the space of decades or centuries. This, of course, is what the creationists are latching onto, and they're saying, aha, so it only works quickly. Creationists believe that we believe that two frogs have sex and give birth to a duck. This, of course, again, shows their misunderstanding of what the term random mutation is. The term does not mean the comic book style mutation where you have parents giving birth to Nightcrawler of the X-Men or something like that. It's sort of where you have a gene or 10 that are miscopied and in such a way that it creates a new trait, resistant, what have you. And that over time, this can give a benefit in reproduction.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the comic books, but creationists have a long history of reading things that are obviously fiction and thinking they're documentaries. You know, the Flintstones, comic books, Terminator.
Bible.
So, I mean, it's not surprising that they would read the X-Men and go, oh, my God! You know.
But you know, again, I mean, what is it, the Crocoduck?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that is, it's like, I can't believe you honestly believe this. I mean, you have to be so willfully ignorant of the facts. And by ignorant, I don't mean rude. I just mean, you know, if you sat down and you had a reasonable conversation with almost anyone who had a basic understanding of evolution, you would go, oh, yeah, of course, that's not how it works. That would be crazy. Right? So, in an odd sort of way, part of what this is doing for people is if you put people in this particular bubble of disinformation, they come up with rational thoughts, but because they're based on irrational premises, right? So
yeah.
The belief in creationism, if you read this stuff, would not sound crazy to you.
This makes sense if the X-Men were real.
Yes. Or, yeah. or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, there was a great example, recently published work, where one scientist over decades actually evolved a bacteria to digest citrate, which is something that this particular breed couldn't do. So most of these have been concerned with evolution. But the creationists believe God created a perfect world and will ensure his creation does not end, well, until he decides to kill everyone during Armageddon. You know, he made it, he gets to break it. Therefore, they get to make claims like it, quote, cannot be shown scientifically that man-made pollutants will one day drastically reduce the depth of the atmosphere's ozone layer, although it has. God has provided checks and balances in creation to prevent any of global upsets that have been predicted by environmentalists, i.e., climate change. In fact, I was just listening to an interesting article about liberals saying, well, where is Fox News saying about this big heat wave that's hitting the United States that's killing people and all sorts of things like that? But again, this is sort of why you get things like the Republicans in the U.S. and the conservatives here in Canada that have been sort of pushed to reject the idea of climate change and a lot of environmental things because of the power of the evangelical movement. Oddly enough, it also provides a great example as to why religion is also antithetical to really any science. If a fundamentalist fundamentalist Christian accepts climate change, then they make two dangerous acknowledgments. First, that God's creation is not perfect, and that when it says in the Bible that after the great flood, God will ensure the world is a nice place to live until the end times, then climate change will make the earth not a nice place to be in. It will essentially be a refutation of the promise of God. So it is sort of the first step in rejecting biblical literalism. Related to that is, if you accept that science can show, prove climate change, then why not accept scientific evidence for things like solar fusion, for evolution, for the great length of time from creation, to the unnecessity of a God at all? It is a slippery slope of rationality, and creationists want nothing to do with that. The A-Science curriculum is not educating children, but to arm them with the ability to reject science when they are free from the cocoon at home, schooling. Teach a child not to learn, and they will be ignorant for life, so saith the Lord. Fatsyism?
That's pretty accurate. I mean, it's also an interesting counter-argument to sort of, I guess you could say, those who sort of say that this kind of religious fundamentalism is a very small minority. Well, actually, it is a small minority that has tremendous clout. I mean, they've brainwashed the right-wing movements of the world into adapting this as science policy. It is a disaster.
Not remarkable, because I mean, one of the ironies of this is when you have so indoctrinated and controlled a group of people like the fundamentalist evangelicals, they can work in mass, which means, you know, you get a lot of people who believe in cause X or cause Y, and some people will kind of believe in that, but to get them to come out and do the vote is quite often quite hard to do. So this sort of indoctrination not only it helps them punch above their weight, essentially.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, could you imagine if, back in the early age of the exploration, when Portugal and Spain and England were sending ships to find the New World, imagine if the Pope had convinced them, don't do it, your boats will fall off the edge of the world. Like, they were pretty stupid back then, but they weren't that stupid.
No.
And they're doing it now with climate change. I mean, it's so ridiculous. And I can't understand why anyone doesn't slap them in the face and say, are you crazy?
Well, it's all in this interlocking web of things, right? I mean, A leads to B leads to C. If you have a house of cards, no matter how ridiculous it may sound, you cannot let that one card fall out because the whole house might cave in. We're going to pause for a little break, but when we come back, we will leave the realm of the physical scientists for the Christian homeschool view on the social scientists. Sciences.
Sounds interesting.
Yes.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. Compared with a star.
But
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So we have been discussing the anti-science ACE teaching. Now we're going to take a look at the social science messaging. Now, beyond the bad science, the ACE curriculum also portrays history and civics in a less than honest light. Many will know the contentions that the U.S. and Canada were founded by fundamentalist Christians, that the nations itself were intended to be Christian nations, and that the proof can be found in our founding document. Factually speaking, I guess it is true that the people who founded these countries were, in one form or another, Christians. In the U.S. Case, a significant number of them were deists, who largely held that there was a God who got things sort of started, then buggered off to go watch TV or something. Now, the idea of separation of church and state is quite strong, if at times controversial, and well defended in its historical documents, at least in the United States. Canada, though, it's a little less clear. It's not actually mentioned in the 1867 Constitution, but our more recent attempt has added the line, Canada is founded upon a principle that recognizes the supremacy of God. That said, it is not so much this case we're really sort of talking about, but the other misleads, other areas that they're going to go into. Okay, so to be fair, a number of the examples that I have found are a decade old or more, and many of them have been actually published by other homeschool textbook people, such as Abeka Book and Bob Jones University Press. For those who don't know, Bob Jones University is an accredited private for-profit nut job Christian university in the United States. However, in 2009, it was ranked 293 in Forbes Best Universities out of 600 listed. So it's middle of the road, but it's not something to be laughed at. Abeka Books is the largest Christian textbook publisher in the world and is affiliated with the Pensacola Christian College, an unaccredited fundamentalist independent Baptist college in Florida. Now, according to these books, only 10% of Africans can read or write because Christian missionary schools have been shut down by the communists. Now, of course, this isn't true in any country. Actually, the worst recorded nation I could find is Mali, which has a literacy rate of 26%. Average for Africa is over 50%. Not well over, but over 50%. Now, of course, don't get me wrong. This is horrible. It's atrocious. And we should do whatever we can to sort of improve this particular situation. But it is not as dire as the as portrayed by this educational material, which is intended, I think, really to increase the ignorance of children. What I did find interesting, though, is that they weren't so much worried with the suffering of Africans, and isn't it sad that they're not learning, but, oh, look at us poor Christians, our missionaries are being persecuted. Their emphasis seemed to be somewhat wrong. They also defended apartheid. Now, according to them, quote, the government must be responsible to the taxpayers who provide the money that the government spends. Since it is true only taxpayers should be given the privilege of voting, the apartheid policy of South Africa is a modern example of this principle. Under the apartheid system, the population of 5 million whites controls most of the nation's wealth. If apartheid were done away with, the 20 million blacks, who are not taxpayers, would be given the privilege of voting. Within a short period of time, they would control the government and the means of taxation. The power to tax is the power to destroy. Heavy taxation would come as a burden for property owners, yada, yada, yada. Essentially, it's saying that, you know, sure, apartheid isn't a great thing in the world, maybe, but to just get rid of it would create an even worse mess. Now, there's a strong element in these to uphold the status quo. Now, this is not really so much about the status quo in South Africa, but an attempt to reinforce the sort of libertarian ethos popular among many anti-government fundamentalists who see, in theory, the only purpose for government is to enforce moral laws and to protect the church. Take note also that the concept of voting in a particular text was seen as a privilege and not a right. One has a right to their religion, but not a right to control their lives via democracy.
Mm.
Another line, the Ku Klux Klan, in some areas of the country, tried to bring meaningful reform, fight the decline of morality, and use the symbol of the cross. In some communities, it achieved certain respectability as it worked with politicians. Now, the fact that those politicians were bigots and racists seems to be missed. And the fact that just because you use a cross doesn't make this a holy mission.
Jeez, what are they going to do, praise Hitler next? Like,
yeah.
I mean, they're just knocking off their own... They're just destroying their own arguments. They don't do anything. It's just like, yes, let's read more of what they have to say.
Well, but you see, the thing that comes up here is that we know better.
Yeah.
And that's where this becomes very pernicious, because these children don't know better. There arises in the evangelical movement an uncomfortable, giving them the benefit of the doubt, truth that if you are a scriptural literalist, slavery was not a sin. That actually... it is more important in this curriculum to maintain the tradition than it is to sort of right wrongs, unless, of course, they're religious wrongs. I mean, one of the big problems that the people who tried to get rid of slavery had to do is that the Bible really comes out strongly, especially Old Testament stuff, in saying that slavery is good, you should have slaves, there's nothing wrong with slaves, what are you guys all talking about? Many people may not know that, you know, another argument they have besides the biblical thing is that the established churches saw that man's superiority over slaves was sort of a representative of God's superiority over men. It agreed with the biblical notion that everything was created for a purpose, and to change the order would be sort of sacrilegious. Fortunately for slaves and apologists, religion is fiction, so one can rewrite the narrative to suit shifting purposes or public opinion. There's also, of course, some overt racism. Overt might not be a little strong word, but in most of the ACE works that I was able to see, everyone was white in the graphics. The videos were white, the animations were white. Although this is more of an American issue, recent issues of the Confederate flag, which sits atop government buildings in South Carolina, the Mississippi state flag, which incorporated the Dixie flag until 2001, and was the subject, I believe, of a South Park episode, and the sort of on-again, off-again sort of Confederate pride that a lot of Southern states have, it just creates a weird dichotomy, because, again, a lot of this sort of fundamentalism is in the Southern United States, or at least these books are published by people writing sort of to that audience, which leads to an interesting cross-pollination of craziness.
Yeah.
Another line from one of their works is, God used the Trail of Tears to bring many Indians to Christ. Now, for those people out there who don't know what the Trail of Tears are, and correct me, Ethan, if I get this slightly wrong, in the early 1800s, native tribes that were living in, I think it was Virginia, South Carolina, that sort of area, and had essentially become Europeanized. They had built houses, they elected a government, they had done all their things, but they were natives. The government at that time, and I think it was Andrew Jackson, said, no, this is white man's land. We've got a reservation for you in Nebraska. And you go, actually, I don't think it was that far away, but I mean, it was hundreds of miles away.
Yeah, yeah.
And you all have to pack up and move there. And they had to walk there, right? I mean, we're not talking, it's not days where you could catch a bus and go there. And along the way, a significant percentage of them died, right, from starvation, from exposure to the elements. When they got there, there was nothing there for them. So the first years that they were there, they suffered atrociously. It was a very horrible, horrible effect. Now, the only thing I can come up with this is that the Aboriginal people, they didn't get Jesus. So they had to experience something like Jesus on the cross. So this was sort of their own form of crucifixion. You know, it helped them suffering. Through suffering, we come to know God. Although most of the ACE material I could access was not quite as horrific as this, there was still the implied and at times overt superiority of the Europeans, who were, of course, blessed with the word of God. In their praise for early missionaries, we are often given the impression that their great efforts and sacrifice on the part, on their part as white men, was given to rescue savages from their primitive godless condition. Again, there's so much inherent racism involved in that. Now, in an odd turn, there's also a lot of things where, like, the Great Depression was greatly exaggerated by propagandists, including people like John Steinbeck, to advance the socialist agenda. Unions have always been plagued by socialists and anarchists who use labor to destroy free enterprise systems whose hard working have created America. Now, of course, these two links do have some racist connotations, as mentioned earlier, because minorities do tend to suffer more from inequality than the majority race. There are some things, though, that make socialism and unions threatening to fundamentalists. First, Christianity is fundamentally an authoritarian social structure intended to ensure that the power of the religious elites or social elites, because they quite often overlap, is maintained, and that the social status quo that gives them their power is also maintained. Socialism encourages equality, the breaking down of barriers, a more egalitarian society. Now, of course, this, strictly speaking, is not anathema to Protestant teaching. In fact, egalitarianism is a strong part of many Protestant faiths, but not to biblical literalists. You are encouraged to read the Bible on your own. In fact, a constant thread in ACE's curriculum is to memorize biblical passages. At the end of every page, it says, "Now memorize Timothy 4:18." But reading and thinking are two different things. Socialism and unions encourage people to stand up for themselves, to not accept the status quo, but to demand equality. Both tend to emphasize power through education, that ignorance is a prerequisite to subjugation and exploitation. Again, superficially, this should not be a major problem for the church, but once you start to question the right of the factory owner to run your life, this can quickly lead to them asking, well, why should I let the pastor or this old book rule my life as well? And there you get the whole idea that if people become educated and they kind of are able to think for themselves, they may start thinking differently and the whole house of cards falls down.
Right. And the other thing too about, you know, the connection between religion and different branches of Christianity in general with sort of the idea of, authoritarian governments. There's such a gauntlet of branches of Christianity, and they've all at times supported various theocracies and authoritarian governments. I mean, one of the reasons that that made the Ku Klux Klan so kind of strange was their obsession with, keeping down black people, keeping down Jews, and keeping down Catholics, you know, or the sort of weird way that England and also the Scandinavian countries Protestantized, or whatever you call that, reformed. Right. Yeah, that's the way. Anyway, but you look at the way that different rulers have sort of pragmatically and shrewdly manipulated the religious overtures to suit their needs, you know. And honestly, if you think that, you know, the Flintstones was reality, it's pretty easy to mold whatever it is you want to say out of the hodgepodge that is the Bible.
Well, you know, and actually, I think we're going to return to this topic next week with a little bit of sort of the implications of what all this is. But you're hitting at it quite right, Ethan, is that this is not intended to educate people. It is not intended for you to learn things, because to learn things makes you independent, and they don't want independence. They want sheep. Everyone must blindly follow the leader, in their case, the pastor, God, Jesus, what have you. And literally, if you do not do this, you will be burning in hell forever. I mean, the stakes for these people, too, are literally quite high. And you mentioned the connection here with the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, you got a perfect trifecta. I mean, one, Catholics are ruled by the Pope, and we all know the Pope is the devil's representative on earth, at least if you're a Protestant. The people of Jewish extraction, the Jews, of course, are evil, corrupt parasites on society trying to steal your money and that sort of thing. And, of course, we all know the blacks are sex-obsessed people out to rape the women. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are not true things, but people in the South literally believe that because they went to the church and the church said, well, the Jews killed Jesus. They got to be bad. They learned that the Catholic Church is a form of oppression and you need to find Christ on your own. They're bad. That God said that Seth was, well, I'm going a bit more, I think, divergent on my theology here, but a lot of Christian evangelicals think that the blacks are sort of cursed by God before their sins that they have done, the curse of Cain, I think it is, right?
Yeah.
Or even just, again, it's God's natural order that some people have to be above others. I mean, it draws into this whole thing we mentioned, I think, last week, about how racism itself has kind of changed. One of the reasons why British people felt superior is because they were Protestant, and inferior races like the Italians and the Spanish and the French were inferior because they were Catholics. And that was actually one of the signs that they were a less evolved people because of that, which, of course, I mean, is nuts.
Yeah, well, absolutely. When you believe in nonsense, it's pretty easy to make that nonsense, you know, your go-to guide for whatever crazy thing you want to justify.
Crazy.
Well, we're actually really out of time here on the show, so we should go to our skeptical highlights.
I have one this week.
Okay.
Mind Lab. Mind Lab is a laboratory of the mind, housing 4 short introductory movies and 16 trials to which you can experience visual phenomena, illusions used to study psychological experiments. Essentially, it's a website. It's really well designed. There's going to be a link on our webpage where you go things and you think, well, you know, seeing is believing. Well, after you go through these tests, you're going to go, holy crap, I don't know anything. Which maybe has been designed by the ACE people.
It's
really cool. They do a lot of, you know, your visual blind spot, how your perception diminishes over space and time.
Well, my skeptical highlight really fits in, I guess, with the theme of education, because it's called Welcome to Skepticism 101, the Skeptical Studies Curriculum Resource Center. And it's put on by skeptic.com, and they've released this new resource for teachers and skeptics for, you know, classrooms and public education. And it's got all kinds of great things, like a free repository of resources for students, like PowerPoint presentations, books for study groups, reading lists, in-class exercises, course syllabi, all kinds of great things that you can use in your classroom to help make your students more skeptical. And it's a great little thing that's all been composited. It's all free, and it's anyone can access it. And you can find all that information on skeptic.com. We'll have a link to it on the show notes. So a great way to counteract some of the bad educational methods we've talked about on today's show.
See, now, for those students out there who listen, are part of homeschooling, Christian homeschooling, instead of porn, tonight go out and learn something about skepticism.
Yeah, well, assuming they're listening to our show right now.
Yeah, well, you know.
You never know. They might find it. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
These stars went unstable in their later years, and then exploded, scattering their enriched guts across the galaxy. Look up at the night sky. We are part of it. The universe itself exists within us. We are stardust.